tonight we are waiting for the button to be pushed. Tonight, I have the distinct pleasure to introduce Winnie Yu. Winnie is one of the founders and owners of Tiant's Fine Tea. She has been aptly and justly described as one of the instigators of the tea renaissance in the United States over the last decade. And she is, in fact, one of the people whose acumen in selecting and making tea available here in the United States is something that we and you, our customers, have had the advantage of enjoying for a number of years. And she was very generous to suggest that she would be happy to come up and do a talk here. I immediately thought, you know, we've never had anyone talk about the actual people who actually go out and pick the tea, process the leaves, create this wonderful substance that we enjoy and hear. And I can't think of a single person better qualified to tell us about that tonight. So please join me in welcoming Winnie Yu.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I'll sit down. Is that okay? I'm not very tall, so either way, it's about the same height. Should we turn the lights down?
Yeah, I'm just about to start doing that.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I don't know if I could be called an instigator, but I started this business with a few friends of mine only because for one reason, which was that we drank a lot of tea. We drank a lot of tea, and we had tastes for only good tea because we're used to drinking very good tea from Asia. And living in this country was difficult. We didn't have a lot of access to good tea or things sometimes not even considered tea. You know, for example, sometimes you go to the supermarket and you'll find sleepy time and you think, oh, what is sleepy time? Never heard of that in Asia, you know. And then you find out it's not actually tea, and so, you know, we'll go to Asia once a year, twice a year, when we visit our families and bring back suitcases full of tea for each other. And, you know, we'll run out in a month and then somebody else will have to take a trip. So a few years later, you know, I traveled a lot, so I became the designated purchaser. And also because I actually knew a lot of the farmers through families and some of the tea masters that I grew up with in Hong Kong. Introduced me to a lot of the farms, and I would be visiting them every year when I'm in Asia anyway. So I would come back with most of the tea, and so that's how it all began. And we figured that, you know, we should just bring in a little more tea so we can buy it at a discount, at a wholesale discount. So we started a tea room so we can enjoy our own tea and our friends can hang out. Anyway, so I wanted to talk about one of my favorite teas in the world that few of us have had, first of all, the advantage of enjoying, except for, you know, Rob and Stuart's support here. But even fewer of us have ever been to these locations. They're beautiful mountains. They're not tourist spots. There are no hotels and places that you can stay. So no one probably has ever been to Phoenix Mountain, right? Raise your hand if you have. I know for a fact none of you have, because I'll tell you a story later.
What part of China is it in?
Ah, okay, I'll get to that.
Because I did live in China.
Uh-huh. China is about the same size as the U.S. So where Phoenix Mountain would be like Florida, maybe Georgia, you know, kind of the southeastern part of China. Okay. Now, Wulong teas are a distinct family of teas. You might have heard of green teas. Most of you have had black teas from India. You might have had blends of teas. A lot of us have not had oolong teas unless you've been to a specialty tea store that really cared about what we call connoisseur teas, because oolong teas are really the connoisseur's tea. Not only rare and difficult to produce, requires a lot of expertise, requires a lot of craftsmanship, hands-on craftsmanship. There are competitions held for Wulong teas and auctions for Wulong teas. Okay? Competitions for, let's say, Phoenix Mountain Wulongs. Competitions for Taiwan Wulongs. Very prestigious awards are, you know, won and given. So people in China and people in, you know, the rest of Asia take their teas very, very seriously, particularly their Wulongs. Phoenix Mountain is a very remote area in the middle of nowhere, but has one of the longest and oldest traditions of Oolong teas. I like this shot because you can't really tell what that is. It looks like your tree in the backyard. So just some technical information about what Oolong teas are, and for those of you who are very technical that want to know more, tea is Camellia sinensis. It's a kind of camellia from China originally, and that's why it's called Camellia sinensis, Sino. And there are two types, the shrub types and the tree types, and we're going to devote our time on the tree types today, called Chao Mu, one of the oldest kinds. They can live up to 40 feet tall or taller, and I think the oldest existing tree right now is 2,700 years old and still living, growing strong, so we don't know how long it'll live. Most of the modern day tea shrubs are, you know, about 2 or 3 feet tall, typically live 15, 25, 50 years. They can live up to 100 years. And some of the oldest styles of oolongs are the phoenix or the wuyi types that are long twisted. And then you have the newer kinds that are rolled into little pearl or pellets. Okay, are you all familiar with the different types of oolongs? Okay. So Phoenix Mountain, that's a picture of one of the peaks where the old wild trees live. One of the oldest kinds of oolongs in the world, from an area that had the original Gongfu tea culture. Gongfu tea means not martial arts, but skillful tea or a highly skilled tea preparation. There was a culture of tea in China called Gongfu tea, which means drink your tea very strong, very concentrated, and endlessly, maybe on the hour by the hour. People there really drink a lot of tea, and I have some pictures of it later. Phoenix teas are very rare. It's grown only in one mountain and has command some of the highest prices in, you know, the world of oolongs. And it's situated in an area in Guangdong. Guangdong is the southernmost province. You know, you've all heard of Canton. That's one of the three top cities in China. It's the southernmost port city near Hong Kong. It's kind of close by to there. It's about 4 hours from there. That's a picture of one of the trees. I think that tree is about 400 years old. And good thing the farmer just happened to have walked up there, because then you can see how tall it is. Now, in order to harvest from this tree, of course, you have to climb up to it. These trees are called single grove trees, single tree teas.
So is the tea, is the tree a different species than the bush, or is it all Camellia sinensis?
It's all Camellia sinensis, and there was a previous slide that showed the two types. I'm sure you can't pronounce this. Q-I-A-O is actually pronounced Chao Mu. Chao Mu is actually the tree type. And then you have the Guan Mu, which is the shrub type.
So that's just both. The way in which it's been treated and grown?
Subspecies. Two types of subspecies, yeah. So these are the original types, which are trees.
How long have the bushes been around?
The bushes usually live anywhere from, they're harvestable after 5 years, but 15 to 25.
I mean, when were they created? Were they hybridized by humans, or are they a natural occurring?
They could be sexual or asexual. So it could be grafting, could be from seed, could be from roots.
But did humans
cultivate? Yes.
Cultivate
yes.
The bush?
Yes. You can cultivate the bushes. The trees are more of the original wild, you know, grown. Types, and the shrubs are, the bush types are generally cultivated, farmed, harvested. Maybe I should step back. I don't know how many lectures on tea you've had, but tea was discovered in China about 4,700 years ago. So almost 5,000 years of tea in China. So it's about as long as the Chinese civilization. It was discovered as a medicine, you know, written down and recorded as how many uses tea had in one's health. And specifically, it was recorded that it was very effective in purging poisons. What they mean by poisons is toxins in the liver. So basically, anything that we tend to accumulate in our liver, tea is able to purge. The Phoenix teas were first discovered from the Song Dynasty, so it's approximately 1,000, maybe 1,200 years ago. And the Phoenix Mountain is a range an area, and the highest peak is 1,500 meters, and that is about 6,000 feet, maybe? Close to there, 6,000 feet, and that's the highest peak. The best premium Phoenix teas are from that Wudong Peak. So we tea snobs often, you know, classify high mountain versus low mountain teas, or valley teas, or flatland teas. Okay, that would be a high mountain tea. And anything over 800 meters is generally considered a high mountain tea. Then you have the lower elevations, and then you have valley or flatland. Guess where Lipton teas come from? Definitely flatland. Now, I like this picture because Phoenix teas were first named Phoenix by the fact that the trees were so old and gnarly. You know, they look like old, you know, characters or something. But the leaves look like beaks. So they named it Phoenix for the beak of the Phoenix bird. And there is a recorded history of cultivating this tea for over 1,000 years. Now, just some more dry information. The highest ranked tea is called single growth, meaning that you harvest one tree at a time and you never mix the batches of tea. Okay, so imagine you have all these bushes and you're going to pick them, and you pick 50 kilos of tea and you mix them all together and you send it out. That's not what happens here usually. You pick one tree at a time. Okay, especially important if you're in a competition and you want to make sure that that particular batch is the best batch possible. The water immortal, you might have heard of that, is another type of the Phoenix tea, and it's considered the third rank, so a little bit lower than the single growth. So whenever you hear Phoenix single growth, you know that's the highest grade. And more particularly specific to this type of tea is that each tree has its own fragrance. So you cannot mix the trees because, you know, you'll be blending different fragrances together and you don't want that. Each tree has its own fragrance. So we have one that's called honey fragrance. Luckily, there are many trees that have the honey fragrance. But we're going to try one today that's called almond fragrance. There are only 5 trees that have that fragrance. Okay, total. There's one called ginger flower. I had the advantage of tasting it. There's only one tree that has that fragrance. Okay, so it would never leave China. It would never leave that mountain, basically, so we'll never get to try it. But we do have the almond. Not bad. So, you know, that's the farmer that I buy the tea from, Mr. Lin. And we ask him, so how do you know which tree has what fragrance? You know, are there signs? Did they tell you? And he says, no. Do you know which of your kids are named, you know, whatever? I said, I don't have kids, but sure. He said, that's how I can tell. I said, okay. That's my friend Sebastian. We were traveling in Phoenix this year, and I have a funny story about that.
Do the trees keep the same fragrance year after year, or does
yes.
it change in time?
Yes, and they don't know why one tree would have one fragrance or the other. They'd be grown, you know, next to each other. But, you know, why this tree turned out to have that fragrance or another, it's really mysterious.
So how much tea do you get off one tree?
Depends on the size of the tree and the season.
So like the 5 trees that are almond fragrant.
Oh, that one. So that actually we got about 20 pounds. That's about 10 kilos. Some years are more and some are less. These are some of the well-known or popular fragrances. Okay, I mentioned ginger flower. Cinnamon, those are all very, very rare. I had one called pomelo. It actually tasted like pomelos or grapefruit. The almond. And the Song second generation is extremely well known because it's a grafting of the original Song dynasty tree from over 1,000 years ago. And when Mao was alive, Chairman Mao, he thought the Song dynasty tree was his favorite tea of the entire world, so they quickly changed the name to the East is Red for that. and right after he died, they quickly changed it back to Song. So now, you know, yeah, anyway. But the ones that are most commonly available are the top 3, the yellow branch, orchid, and the honey. And I believe we'll serve the honey today.
In fact, we might start brewing
that would
up
be great.
Right now.
So tea that tastes like honey without any honey added. So what are some of the criteria for harvesting this tea. Now, I'm going to talk about people real soon, but it's important to know about the tea as well. There are over 80 fragrances identified. They're very careful not to mix any of them. These teas are only harvested in two seasons, the spring, which is right around May, and winter, which is right around now, okay, October, November. You have to harvest in sequential leaf order. I've never actually harvested any of these teas. I don't qualify to do that. But you're supposed to harvest in a particular leaf order of that tree. And one grove at a time, from young to mature leaves, from 1 to 4 p.m., when the sun's at a certain angle. Never harvest anything that's wet and rained on or morning leaves, because if you harvest them when the leaves are wet, then that means you have to dry it indoor or someplace that where the probability of the leaves wilting improperly or molding improperly, you know, are all possible, and you don't want that. So you want the sun to dry the leaves. This is one of the foggiest mountains I've ever been to. It's blindingly foggy. So when do you actually get to pick the leaves? So that's why it's so rare.
How much of the leaves are picked at one time? Like 50% of the tree, or?
It depends on the conditions, because again, the sun has to be drying these leaves properly.
But you have to leave some leaves on the tree for the tree to, right?
Absolutely. So it's usually in flushes. So generally the first flush, which is the first spring growth of the tree, the leaves up to a certain size, and they'll pick those particular mature leaves at that size, and then they don't pick again until the next season, which is winter. So here you have it. Its leaves have been harvested, and they're laying it out in the sun to dry. Okay. And then what happens now, a lot of these next series of photos are going to be dark because they have to do this in the dark. Okay. You can't have sun exposure on these leaves once they've wilted up to a certain stage. And usually this happens late at night. And if I'm there, I'm usually up all night with these farmers, because the leaves don't stop wilting just because you have to go to sleep. So they have to keep processing. And the next morning they bring another harvest. So it's a 1 month process where they just keep not sleeping for a month.
Sort of like the crush here.
Yes. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's exactly like that. So, you know, the leaves come in, they have to sort it, they have to aerate it a certain way, make sure it's fluffy, make sure there's enough oxygen between the leaves cushioning it, and that it's not wilting improperly. Now, oolong teas are defined as partially oxidized leaves. Okay, you have unoxidized, which is white and green teas, no processing, just drying. And partially oxidized, which means rubbing the outer edges of the leaves off a little bit so that it's slightly bruised, slightly crushed, and then that allows the fragrance and the fruity flavors of the teas, or different fragrances of the teas, to come out to the exterior of the leaf, and then you quickly arrest that by baking it. Okay, so partially oxidized, it could be oxidized anywhere from 20%, 20-30% in Taiwan, all the way to 60-80% in China. Okay, depending on style and preference. There's a big charcoal oven there, and it looks kind of ghastly, but what they're doing is they're sticking the leaves into these pans and to be roasted by charcoal fire. There's a process called killing the green, taking out the long taste of the leaves. Okay, when first harvested from the field, it's got a very green lawn taste. You want to churn that and break that up so that taste goes away, and then you oxidize it.
Do any green teas come from this region?
No. Each region usually makes exactly just one kind of tea. Whatever the conditions are best for growing that kind of tea and processing it, that's all they... And so I always considered myself lucky that I lived in Hong Kong as opposed to any of these places in China. Because had I grown up drinking Phoenix tea, I would never drink any other tea. If I drank green tea, I would probably never... Phoenix tea, you know. One of my favorite teas is Pu'er. Nobody would drink Pu'er if you drank any other tea. It's this dark fermented tea, you know. So growing in Hong Kong means I drink basically everything as long as it's great. this machine here makes the shape of the Phoenix tea. It's a long, twisted, longitudinal. Thank you. So we're going to be tasting the honey fragrance Phoenix tea. Great, perfect. Thank you. That's what the leaves look like. Okay. Doesn't look particularly attractive, except that that would be considered an extremely good batch of tea. It's supposed to be long and twisted. It's supposed to look like eel or bark. And you're supposed to see little red borders. I mean, this is all very technical. If you want to either become tea connoisseurs or tea experts when you buy tea, or you can just trust Robin Stewart and buy from here, then you know you're getting the good stuff, right? So you don't have to know any of this. But you're supposed to be able to get 10 or more steepings out of each batch of tea. Now, if you get a tea bag, obviously you know you get, you know, one steeping. Even that tastes good. But these Phoenix teas, you're supposed to get 10 or more steepings.
Do they lose caffeine as you steep on?
They do, but there's not a whole lot of caffeine from these teas anyway.
Does it take a while also for the soul to keep opening up?
Yes. Very short infusion. Now, do you all taste the honey?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
so
smell it as well.
Very smooth,
very, very
rounded kind of taste. It's like an internal fragrance. It's not just the fragrance that you smell, but it's like an internal fragrance on your tongue. It's one of the most, you know, who needs perfume teas, right, if you can have teas like this? I just want, this is for a laugh. I on top of the mountain is this place. And I've been there so many times. No one's ever been there, but the sign says tea room with chicken congee inside the tent. I'm going, there's nothing in there, but that's the tea room on top of Phoenix Mountains. Okay. But seriously, I'm going to switch gears a little bit to look at who are the people that grow these teas and who are the people that consume these teas, because we've got to remember, most Phoenix teas never leave the mountain. 99% of it never leaves the mountain. It's all consumed, yes, it's all consumed by the locals. And that's because the locals drink a lot of tea. They have one of the most concentrated, avid tea population in the entire country, as well as supposedly the lowest cancer rate in the entire country as well, but we don't know if that's the correlation or not. They absolutely drink tea on the hour by the hour, if not by the minute. And if you think there's a lot of Starbucks, wait till you see how many tea shops are in this city called Shanto. There's literally, my friends, the farmers, own like 20 of them, like in three blocks, they have 20 shops. And I said, do they actually, are there that many people? Oh, yeah. They sell out their entire crop every year. I thought that was a great picture. You have the little, made of wicker bamboo. It's great. But, you know, the city here is pretty old, not modernized by and large like the rest of China is today, and they don't care to modernize. There's no industries there. Still on the bikes. Everybody in China is now buying SUVs, but they're still on bikes. They got these, you know, old little brick stone roads. And so, you know, they don't care about anything there except drinking tea.
What's in it?
Well, you're drinking it right now. So as you can see, I love going there. You know, you go anywhere and you're like, serve tea. So this is early in the morning. You go to the park and all these, you know, seniors go hang out 5-6 o'clock in the morning. Now, if you go to anywhere in China, they will go hang out at 5-6 o'clock in the morning in the park, and they're doing Tai Chi. Here, they just sit down and drink tea.
Much more reasonable.
Much, it's, you know, same health benefit. You know, you're sitting down, you know. The only thing is that's funny is that, you know, each of these seniors brought their own kit. So maybe they share the hot water, but they definitely have their own pot, their own cups, and their own tea. So if you were sitting down with five people and you brought five cups, isn't one person enough to bring, you know, you brought your own kit? No, they have to bring their own kit and their own tea because, you know, my tea is bringing your tea. And boy, you know, if you didn't bring the right tea that day, that's bad, you know. You're not cool. So I go to the park and I walk around and everyone offers me tea, you know, because if you all have five cups of tea and there's like five of them there. But, you know, seriously, how does it work? Well, everyone basically is revolving around the drinking and the consumption and the harvesting and farming of tea there. So everyone's lives are basically related to the tea. And because it's whole mountain ranges, you know, of tea leaves to harvest, and they all grow at the same time, right? what happens in the spring is that everyone pitches in, so it's like a commune. Everyone pitches in to pick tea. You know, these people are born harvesting tea, and they will keep harvesting until they're 80 years old. Okay, but however, the optimal age for a tea picker is 30 to 60 year old females, because they have the most dexterity. They can scavenge, or you know, look at a field of billions of tea leaves and be able to hand pick which are the optimal size mature leaves to pick by hand. Okay, every single one of these by hand. You're picking about 20,000 leaves for a pound, and they can pick about 20 pounds a day. So very fast, very accurate. They don't let the men do the picking. The men do the processing. Now, some of you might know I have another passion, that's tofu.
on that last picture, were those eucalyptus trees in the background?
No, they don't have any eucalyptus trees in China.
Good, I was thinking that would be odd. Yeah. And these are the tea bushes.
These are the tea bushes. This is actually the low valley land. I think that's where Pete's gets the Phoenix tea. Well, he fires my friends. I can say that. Flatlands usually make more sense for corporations because you can actually run a machine through the field. You can pick off the top. It's not accurate. It's not the best quality. You can be bruising the teeth unnecessarily, etc. But it sure is easier because most of the teeth are grown on very steep terraces. I think I have another picture down the road. Very steep terraces, which means that you have to pick by hand because you cannot take a lawnmower and go through, you know, by machine. So corporations will not pay for people to hand pick teas. Okay. But anyway, that's just a side. You know, what do the women do during downtime when they're not harvesting tea the two times in a year is, you know, they make tofu.
So they have great tofu there. Well?
They grow soybeans. Yeah. Some of the people there. Now, this guy, I love this guy. He's never worked any time of the times that I've seen him. And I've always wondered why. He's not very friendly. He never talks to me. But that day, he actually served me tea. And that's because my farmer friend told me, well, you know, he just got his payoff because he owns the one ginger flower tree. It happens to be in his backyard as opposed to my friend. Darn it, you know. And so the government officials bought it and paid. He only had a kilo, you know. Someone asked me how much yield, you know. A kilo is about 2.2 pounds. This tree yielded 2.2 pounds. He got $2,000, which is 15,000 RMB. That's enough for him to live for 3 years.
Yeah.
That is a lot, and especially since they grow all their own food and they don't go anywhere and they don't have cars and they don't even have TV. They don't have anything they need.
And they don't have to buy tea.
They don't have to buy tea or coffee. So what do they need, you know? Nothing. So that is so much money for him. He's just sitting there. He's rich. And he's not working. Everyone else is working when I was there because it's peak harvest time. So everyone's just jamming crazy. And he's not doing anything, sitting back. But this is my friend, Mr. Lin. Not a very flattering picture. It's foggy. You know, this mountain is tall and steep and foggy, blinding fog like a day like this. And you could easily fall off the cliff when you're going up there. So that's additionally exciting for me. But now that I'm older, they actually have a road that you can drive sort of up to it. And I found out that some Indonesian company had paved the road going up to Phoenix Mountain so they can get a big tax deduction from the Chinese government. So we all benefited. But that's the only reason why it even has a road. And so you can actually be a tourist now and go up to Phoenix Mountain. But they make these curves really fast, so I don't know. You may want to close your eyes. So on the peak of the mountain there is where a lot of these trees are actually just wild grown. You know, we call them caretakers more than just farmers because they don't really farm them. They take care of these trees. Okay, they harvest them. They look after them. There's no pesticide use. It's too cold. There are no pests up there. It's too cold and too high. The average temperature there is about 20 degrees in the hottest times and well below zero, 20 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. I think Celsius in kilos, but somewhere. But zero. Yeah. Fahrenheit. I'm sorry. So.
What kind of cultivation then, what kind of maintenance do they do then generally on the trees?
Not much. They harvest them. Sometimes they have to keep them warm when it's too cold.
So how do they do that?
They get hay. Usually they blanket them.
Blanket them.
So it really is like your kids, you know. They don't do much. There's not a whole lot of. They use natural fertilizers like soy meal, you know, it just goes around and around. They grow the soybeans, they make some tofu, grind up the soy meal, put it up there, use it on the roots. So that's about all they do. But yeah, they take care of the leaves. They do observe if there's too much lichen or too much. Other things that grow on it. Now, Mr. Lin lives in this village, and it's one of the, I think, most beautiful villages. You know, it's very clean. It's not like a lot of the Chinese villages that I've been to, where it's like a lot of roosters running around and pigs, and some of them have monkeys. There's some farms that I go to that have a lot of monkeys that live there. You guys have heard of monkey pig tea? Mm-hmm. Not picked by those monkeys. Those monkeys just, they want your sandwiches and things. But Mr. Lin lives here. And this village has always been there. It's been there for as long as there's been tea there. Now, there's my friend Sebastian there. And do you all know Silk Road Teas?
Mm-hmm.
Silk Road Teas? Yeah, David. David was the original proprietor of Silk Road Teas. He's recently in a tea film called All in This Tea. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
In fact, we're going to be sponsoring, Amina Rivers is going to be sponsoring a showing of that at the Sonoma Film Institute at Sonoma State University.
It's a documentary about David.
Yeah.
David was one of the pioneers of bringing tea to this country. He's much older than myself, and he's retired. But he doesn't speak a word of Chinese. He'll go around, you know, all over China. He doesn't know where he's going, but he'll find some place and he'll just get on a bus, and then, you know, he'll go somewhere and then he'll end up somewhere. So his trips take a long time, sometimes like a year before he actually comes back. He's one of the few people that have ever been to Phoenix. Now, when I was there with Sebastian, I've been going to Phoenix for years visiting. This year I went with Sebastian, and he's a tall white American person, and all of a sudden, everybody's coming out to look. They're peeking behind their doors. They're, you know, little kids are giggling and, you know, pointing, giggling. And I'm like, what's going on here? I don't get this kind of reception. And he's like, you know, they're all coming out to look, you know, like people follow him. Finally, I couldn't stand it. I said, what are you guys looking at? And he said, well, you know, that guy is white. I said, don't you guys watch TV? Oh, no, you don't watch TV. Okay, so you've never seen a white person? They said, no, we have. We've seen one ever. And I said, oh, I think I know who that is. He has a hat, and, you know, he's kind of, you know,
larger than life.
Larger than life looking. And one of them was really happy because he actually had a picture of David and on his door. It's like, you know, look, we have a picture of an American white person. And it was really funny, so I go up there and I say, oh yeah, that's David, you know, small world. But now that he's retired, he said, you know, we haven't seen him for 3 years. What happened to him? And I said, he got married, he's retired, but look, I brought you another one. That's how I know none of you have ever been to Phoenix. Anyway, I mean, I just wanted to tell that story because it's such a far and remote place of not being part of the rest of the world, let alone even the rest of China, because the rest of China doesn't look like this anymore. You still have villages, but there are skyscrapers, there are, you know, space-age cities, if you've ever seen Shanghai. There's so much development, so much growth. You know, it's growing by, like, you know, 13% a year, where the U.S. is growing by 1.5%, if not in recession. There's 1.3 billion people in China. Okay, most of them are packed in the cities. So the culture of tea really is, has always been there. It's always been part of people's lives. But how does it fit in with this modern age of, you know, technology and living in the cities? None of that matters to these people. They have no intention of leaving their village, no intention of selling their tea anywhere. They don't know where the tea goes after they gave it to me. They can't imagine that you all are drinking it. I can't imagine.
Huh? All these white people.
I gotta take a picture of this. And oh, they're drinking your tea. I mean, I tell you stories, I tell them stories, you know. That's how I get by. This is the village patriarch. And he's the father of Mr. Lin, so of course he's also Mr. Lin. And I ask him, you know, so how long have you been doing tea here? And figure, you know, 50 years, what, 80 years? He says, oh, about 1,000 years. According to our family genealogy, you know, they have a book that chronicles every generation. We've been here for about 1,000 years doing tea. They're one of the original people growing tea and taking care of these tea trees. So literally, they're like their kids. Every generation have seen that tree, those trees, harvested from those teas. And it's a far cry from, you know, our culture today of not having sort of anything that's permanent, you know, not sort of having any, forget about being close to your land. I mean, I guess we have grapes here, so it's a little bit different. We have some farmlands, but, you know, we don't live close to land. We don't live, nature is not really something that's really part of us. Not a daily part. I mean, we can hike out to, you know, Marin Woods or something, not to the coast here, but you don't have that sort of, you know, nature is part of your family. And not to mention the monkeys and the other animals that are part of the family, but...
Are monkeys indigenous, or did they import them from somewhere?
No, they're indigenous. They're macaque monkeys. Macaque monkeys are original Asian monkeys. Yeah, they're the types of the really round heads and the long tail. Yeah, speaking of monkeys, you know, they really are something, because they're very smart. They work in gangs, you know, see a backpack, and one time, you know, I was in a different mountain, and a couple of them would start trying to distract me, and then out of the corner of my eye, I saw another one coming around this fence, and he's going to leap onto my backpack, and I know how fast they are. They can instantly open the zipper, fish out your lunch or whatever you have, and, you know, and sometimes I'm, you know, constantly, yeah. But, so what happens to all the tea? Well, you know, we're actually very concerned that there's any tea left in the next 50 years. Maybe only from Phoenix Mountain, but a lot of the tea culture, a lot of the new generation of people growing in these agricultural places are that, you know, they see computers, they see wealth, and they see technology. And, for example, a lot of my friends in Taiwan, none of the kids want to be farmers. What are you studying? Computer science? Oh, no. You're not coming back to inherit the farm? No way. That's hard work. So my farmers in Taiwan are not going to see another generation of farmers. They're having some trouble now. They can't find people to harvest the tea. They can't harvest the entire mountain by themselves, you know. So who are going to do these, you know, kind of hands-on labor type of things if you think that you can buy an SUV and work in a computer company in Shanghai, right? For now, this community is very, you know, isolated and insular, and this kid is probably going to grow up, and this is one of the kids that keep peeking at my friend. He's just warm. Finally, I got a picture of him for revenge. but they start at age 8 or 9, and they start learning how to harvest tea. And they start, and they will go through every single process, you know, harvesting to processing to making the teas to judging to grading. Okay. The only things that I learned how to do is judging and grading. I never learned how to harvest or farm. Obviously, I've never lived on a farm but I have a lot of experience grading, judging teas. And this is one of the oldest trees there is. I think that one is, we don't really know. It doesn't look very large because they grow very, very slowly in the fog. But this tree is probably close to 500 years old. That's full of lichen. So, you know, I want to end with a sort of appreciation for the fact that all of you are, you know, waking up to this great experience of tea. That's why you even bother to take a Thursday night here to see some slides about tea, right, and drink some tea. Tea is healthy. Tea is a great connoisseur beverage. There's a huge culture surrounding tea. People are avid tea drinkers like myself that live an entire life drinking tea and can't imagine not living life without tea. And the teas will live forever. But the only problem right now is with technology, with modern living, we're farther and farther away from paying for things like this. You know, we have Starbucks and we have things that are generic and we have, you know, everything's a generic experience. And these teas are harvested twice a year. Every batch is different. Every season is different. Sometimes we have fabulous years. Sometimes we have really bad years. Sometimes there are no teas available whatsoever. And so you will never have the same experience twice. For example, I remember the last great year of Dragonwell was 1996. I don't think we'll ever have another great year of Dragonwell because of too much pollution in China. It's not from a high mountain, it's from a low area. So what's gone is going to be gone. And this is not a generic experience. It's an impermanent, you know, very spiritual, right? It's impermanent, but it's special. And every year you wait for this fabulous batch of tea that may or may not come. For me, that's worth it. It's better than having, you know, blended generic teas from Lipton's that supposedly year after year it's exactly the same. You never know what season it's from. You never know if the farmers, you know, what kind of conditions they harvested them in. They're never going to be hand-picked. They're always going to be blended from five different countries and, you know, six different teas. And you will never have a special experience. So thank you for supporting this tea and supporting artisan teas and handcrafted teas. And it was my pleasure to share my little travel adventure with you.
So you've just been tasting the single grove almond.
Almond, and it's one of the five trees that have this. I bought the whole lot, so I couldn't help it. We never sell it, you know. Oh, we'll drink it.
It's fantastic stuff.
Now this tea is great. It's perfectly smooth. There's no astringency. Okay. A lot of us brew our teas for 5 minutes or 2 minutes, and it's 2 minutes too long. This tea you steep for 15 seconds to 45 seconds for infusion. And you get this perfect finish, either of raw almonds or toasted almonds, depending on the temperature that you steep your tea. Another, you know, example of how, you know, the complexity that tea could be. It's par with any wine or anything else.
What temperature do you use for that?
For Phoenix teas, you want to use a very high temperature, 205 to 208, steep for a very short time, and then drink it relatively cool, which is what you're getting right now. So you steep it hot, and then you let it cool, and then you drink it.
When you buy the teas, do you pay approximately what they get from that area, since they're all drinking teas there, or do you pay more?
I actually pay less. Because I bring them cigars. No, I'm I pay less. Well, I pay wholesale. I buy in lots. I mean, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
And I pay a little more than the communist government official, but a lot less than the retailer, than a retail customer.
Than a retail customer, because they have to maintain a shop.
Right. Right.
And they don't have to do anything special. You just come to them and take a lot of it.
Right. I usually have standing orders because I know these farmers well enough. So whatever they harvest that year, I buy the whole lot. So they know that. Huh?
And that's good for them.
It's good for them because, you know, a lot of the teas that we care to buy are at such premium quality that actually they tithe those to the government. Like I have a green tea called Lushan. They tithe that, and they could never really get paid. You know, they get paid a fraction, and whenever the government feels like paying them. So I actually buy, for want of a better word, sort of like I smuggle the tea from the mountain. Well, they send it out to me. I don't actually smuggle it, but I pay them whatever they want, which is much better than not getting paid from the government.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're supporting.
So they set the price.
They set the price. Yeah.
And they don't keep jacking it up on you because they know it's rare. They must need the money.
They have to. They have. If they had a bad year, let's say going from 50 kilos to 30 kilos, they have to raise the price a little bit because, you know, they're at the mercy of weather and natural conditions. so their livelihood suffers if they didn't grow as much tea as they need to survive for the rest of the year. So they will increase the price based on that. But usually it's pretty fair. It's year to year, it's about the same. The only tea that's we've seen a lot of increase on is Tour.
Where would that be?
Well, there's just silly situation in China right now. People are collecting Tour.
Oh, okay. So demand is going up.
Yeah, so it's like a speculative type situation.
Oh, and because it's better when it's aged, perhaps. So they're buying like a good wine, and then they hope it's good.
Right. Well, it's the only tea that you can collect, because these teas you can probably store away for 5 years, and that's it. If you don't drink it before 5 years is over, it's gonna, it's compost. But Pu'er you can keep sort of indefinitely. You can keep for 100 years. Mm-hmm. So it's the only tea you can collect. It's the tea with the most medicinal properties based on Chinese medicine, so people collect it for various reasons. So it's jacked up the price.
Do you buy that also?
Yeah.
You take it back to your tea shop? Pu'ers?
Yeah, Pu'ers. Again, I grew up drinking Pu'ers. And the best Pu'ers are actually from Hong Kong. Mm. Because it's the most humid place possible. Hottest, most humid place possible.
Yeah.
I used to stand around and not do a thing. I would be just blinking.
Oh.
And sweat was I would literally see sweat shooting out of me. not dripping.
Right.
Yeah. I would see little coming out of my.
We were there in May, and it was not a real humid month, but it was miserable.
It's miserable maybe 300 days of the year.
Yeah.
True. And then the other 60, a typhoon.
Yeah.
I love Hong Kong. I have to go to Hong Kong for my food and connection, every few months. I have to go to Hong Kong. This is it. I don't care. I'm off. Because they have the best food. Well, there's only one thing they care about there, and that's food. Food and shopping, but shopping
food
for
shopping.
Food. Shopping for food.
Have you seen much difference in Hong Kong since it went back?
There was a lot of difference for about a couple years with the real estate, a couple years before and a couple years after 97. And real estate basically plummeted and fell by 50%. And but thereafter, it's revived completely and it's doing really well. Only because Hong Kong has one industry that no one can beat, and that's the banking systems there. People really know how to do banking. They were trained by the Scottish banks. And HSBC and Standard Chartered, those are all banks in Hong Kong. So when China took over, they thought, we'll just have all the banking come out of Shanghai. Well, no one in China actually knows how to do banking because it was a communist country. So quickly they realized they just could not deal with it, so they moved everything back to Hong Kong. So now Hong Kong controls it, and it's the financial hub again for all of China. So
actually came out better. Yeah.
They came out ahead, whereas Taiwan is not doing so well.
But the food is still as good.
Food's fabulous.
Has it changed?
No. Exactly as I remember it. But it's, I go a few times a year, so I have my favorite places to eat, places to drink tea. It's my fix. It's a very different lifestyle from here. I mean, it's a very modern city, but,
You grew up in Hong Kong?
I spent my childhood in Hong Kong, and I have to say I grew up in this country, but I spent a lot of time.
When you came here?
I was 8.
Yeah, because you speak perfectly on accent. I mean, you sound like you were born here for some
generation. But people in Hong Kong are bilingual, so
they are.
I spoke English. Sure.
And so when you go to these farms, you can speak to them in their language, which people like
I speak
about.
Mandarin as well, which is the common language there. So everyone has a different dialect. So within, a kilometer of each other, they'll speak a different dialect.
If you can get along with the Mandarin, then you can speak with him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like if you can speak English here, you can sort of go to the south. That's what I'm saying. I can't. I get to Georgia. It's like, huh? I don't have an accent.
You do.
So it's my pleasure to be here. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was an excellent presentation.
Oh, thank you.
Really, very well done.
Wasn't sure because sometimes it gets too technical. We don't know which part to include.
They've been teaching us for a long time about teas at Many Rivers and tea tastings. So we're not quite as dumb as we were before we knew about Many Rivers.
Well, this is a big dose tonight, and I realized that I neglected in my introduction to encourage you all to go and visit the incredibly beautiful tea room that Tiance has down in Berkeley on 4th Street. And it's a really wonderful, it's an aesthetic experience simply walking in the door, even before you get to the tea bar, sit down and have some of the incredible teas brewed perfectly.
That was our other mission was, I have a very close friend who is an architect, you know, designer called Chang Design at Berkeley. They're award-winning architects. And we've always said, you know, when you go to a Chinese restaurant, it's always kind of gaudy. Mm-hmm. Gold and red and dragons and, you know. That's not us, is it? And he says, no. So we said, let's build a place that looks completely, it's Chinese, but it's completely different aesthetic.
Is
the new one similar to the original?
It's better than the old one.
Yeah, there's this beautiful water falling from the ceiling into a pond. It's just exquisite.
Where
I'm there on weekends.
1127, is that the address? No.
I don't know. It's near Pete's, though.
Yeah.
So the people from Pete's come here and drink. They go next door and they drink tea with us.
Right.
So well, you can't mix coffee and tea, you know. Just
yeah, I wouldn't, but...
Yeah. It's next to the Pete's, two doors from the Pete's.
Okay.
How long have you been there?
For pizza?
One year. I haven't been down there for a while, so I haven't seen you here.
It's funny because, you know, my staff tell me that people come in and they used to ask for, you don't serve cream and sugar? Winnie will kill us if we did. Someone try to sneak in, they'll bring it in their purse.
English tea room.
Winnie's partner that she's mentioned has made, for both establishments, made this incredible single cast, I don't know if it's single cast, but
single cast
tea bar. This new one is actually warm to the touch. When you put your hand on the bar, it's actually like a body temperature. It's just amazing. It's a wonderful. It's really wonderful. Wonderful. So thank you so much for coming. It was really wonderful. So I want to, as is our usual drill, just remind you...